Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today, Frank Bill. Frank, how you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing, Vic?
Real good. We talked a while back. Your first book had come out, and that was Crimes in Southern Indiana. It's a collection of your stories, and we talked about this novel. You had already written it, and you told me about it, and I said, okay, Donnybrook, okay, I'm be looking forward to this one. And now that it's out I read it, I said to myself, I think Frank's written the most violent book I've ever read.
Well, thank you.
Wow, Frank. So what's been going on? I know you just came back from Chicago and Milwaukee. You've been out doing some touring for the book. What's happening with you?
Yeah, I did some local stuff first. I hit Louisville, Kentucky. I did Carmichael's Books. I hit Destination Books in New Albany. And then wife and I drove up north and did Boswell Books in Milwaukee. Had a really, really good turnout. A lot of really big fans. Not often you walk into a bookstore and people are trying to check out and they look and they like recognize you from the back of the cover and want to come over and talk to you. That's always, that's pretty uplifting, you know, how much they just want to tell you how much they enjoyed your work, how they related to it and passed it on to other people and how they enjoyed it. So it's a real good time up there. And then we went to Chicago and the host up there from the bookstore in Chicago, I think it's 57th Street Books, had a little event at the at a bar called Jimmy's Woodland Tap. I think that's the name of it. But I kind of shared a spotlight there with a guy by the name of Scott McClanahan, who wrote a book called Crapalacia. He's from West Virginia. Just killed it. I've never seen anybody do what he's done, other than maybe a preacher under a big tent out in a cornfield. I mean, he was just a really, really good, really good guy. But now I'm back home for a day, and I go back to Indianapolis for tomorrow. I do three events tomorrow, so kind of looking forward to that. And then I have another event in Louisville, Kentucky on Monday I do for 21C. It's for Spalding University, I believe, through Sarah Bam Books. I think it's the name. It's an independent publisher in Louisville, Kentucky. They have a really good reading series, and I felt pretty good to get invited to that. So. Then I get a little bit of a break for a couple of weeks, and I head out to L.A.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is all very exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's that and trying to work a day job. It's still a little overwhelming at first, but yeah.
You saved up some vacation time?
Yeah, I've got quite a bit, but, you know, that'll probably disappear pretty quick, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about Donnybrook before when it was just a thing coming down the road, and now it's hit us, and pretty much a technical knockout here. Tell us the basic plot of this one.
Basically, it's about a struggling class, working class guy who's a bare knuckles fighter by the name of Jarhead Earl, and he's just trying to get away from the poverty of what he has in Kentucky. He doesn't want to work in the coal mines like his stepfather did, and he never really knew he didn't know his real father. And so his entire way to do this is somebody tells him about a huge bare knuckles boxing tournament that takes place in southern Indiana where the winner can basically come away with $100,000. And he's thinking that for him to travel there and win, which he thinks he will win, will help him get him and his girlfriend and his kids out of this life of poverty and struggle that he knows. And, of course, on his travels, there's nothing but conflict. There's always something getting in the way. So, kind of turns into what I don't like things to be boring, so I just kind of turn up the knob on what's not boring and just let it fly.
Okay, so we know that we're going to get to Donnybrook eventually, and it takes
sure.
about two-thirds of the book to get there, and meanwhile, we've created this cast of characters that are all headed that direction, some more quickly than others.
Sure.
One of them's Jarhead.
Yes.
But we also spend a lot of time with a brother and sister duo. And
Liz and Chainsaw Angus, yes. Yeah, Chainsaw at one time had been a bare-knuckles fighter, and he'd never been beat either. But he had an accident. He had a logging. His father had a logging company that he was running, and he kind of sunk it. So he kind of gets mixed up with his sister and learns how to cook crystal meth and becomes like a very, if you want to call it, reputable meth cook for making really good crystal meth, and he's making his money that way. Only his sister's not the greatest of kin you want to be bloodborne next to. So she kind of has her own ideas because he's kind of a rough guy too. You know, he kind of treats her badly, and she wants the money and the meth all for herself, and just kind of to axe him off the side. So yeah, everything just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. If you can imagine. Of course, you've read the book, so you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. And the thing about Liz is she's very eye-catching, particularly in this scenery, because there's a lot of unattractive people.
Oh, yes. Nobody you really want to share a drink with. And if you did, you'd probably lose your wallet and possibly your life. So
yeah.
Yeah, there's, when I had sat down to write it, it was right in the middle of when everything was really going bad for the economy. And a lot of it came from friends that I had known over the years that had gotten mixed up in crystal meth, people that worked in one of the local factories around here. And at the time, everybody thought the factory was going to sink. It didn't sink, thank God. It got bought out by somebody else. But a lot of people lost a lot of their wages as far as being cut down from a large amount. They probably lost about somewhere between $3 to $5 an hour, and it was basically saying, either take this or you won't work here. So a lot of that kind of inspired what I was writing at the time, because there was a lot of people who were struggling, either didn't have a job or they were just fortunate to have a job, you know,
mm-hmm.
in that type of sense. So there was a lot of truth to what was going on at the time. No, there wasn't a bare-knuckles boxing tournament around the area that I know of. That was something that just kind of stuck in my mind from way back in the mid-90s when I worked out with a guy that worked up around Charlestown for a printing company, and we studied martial arts together, and he would always come in talking about some of the guys he worked with on night shift. We were always talking about these bare knuckles boxing things that went on in these warehouses or abandoned places. Of course, I don't know if they ever existed, but he'd always talk about them. Like, hey, you want to go? And of course, we never went, but mm-hmm. It's one of the things that stuck in my mind. At the time, I wasn't a writer, but when I sat down to write, it was just something that kind of, as you're creating things, it's kind of like, hey, why don't we go with this and see what we can make of it? And then, of course, I learned about the Irish Fighting Festival, which is known as Donnybrook, which was a real thing back in the 1800s.
Frank Bill joins us. His novel Donnybrook just published. And the Donnybrook is organized and overseen and... the big profits go to a guy named Belmont McGill, and we eventually meet him and his daughter, and they're quite a pair.
Yes.
Another really nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a really great guy.
Yeah. Okay, but you know, you play some tricks with us because Angus, Chainsaw Angus, he's not a particularly nice guy, but there's a lot of parts of the book where we kind of like him. Maybe it's just because he's beating on these other guys that are even worse than him.
Sure. When I first started writing the manuscript, he was kind of like my hero. Not that I write to think about heroes, but he was kind of my guy to root for. And the problem was when I got him to the Donnybrook, he and him made a fight. So I had to go back and recreate somebody that was just as tough as he was. Because when I sit down to write, I don't really think about who to root for. I just kind of think of a person, and I just want to give their characteristics and tell their story, whether they're good or bad. Mm-hmm. In my case, it's usually bad. But, you know, I don't always see it that way. I just look at people as doing what they can do to get by. But he has a heart, and he's one of the main hearts of the novel, too. And, of course, you've read it, you know how it ends. So
mm-hmm.
I've got a follow-up in the works, and, yeah, he'll be in it. So maybe I'll have a little more heart in this one.
Yeah, we can tell at the ending that there's more to the story. And for those few characters who actually managed to survive this book, we're expecting to see some of them again.
Yes, definitely. You'll see Chainsaw, you'll see some new characters, and of course you'll have some of the people who, as you said, survive. Scar will be one of the main people.
Now, don't be giving any spoilers.
Giving any spoilers because it's the next novel is written completely different. It's told from a different perspective and different points of view of the new characters, and they just basically kind of mingle in with people from Donnybrook. But then it paints a much larger canvas about society in general, I guess. You know, and there's a lot of questions in there. I'm not finished with it, so I can't say what all it's about. But
gotcha.
It hits on a lot of different points, which mainly are class, but different classes. So,
well, I know that Daniel Woodrell is someone who you really admire, and he gave you a very nice blurb for this book. And I was just, when I read the blurb, I thought Frank Bill must have been on cloud nine after he saw this.
Oh yeah, yeah. I never know what to expect from people, you know. But yeah, Daniel. It doesn't get much better than that, to put it that, you know, put it that way. It's just hard to compare anybody to him because he's just a great writer, you know, word, story, characterization. And he's got a good eye for everything he's seen in life and where he's been and what he's done. And, yeah, I highly admire Daniel.
And, our own Ohio writer, Donald Ray Pollack, has been a booster of yours too. And my observation would be that reading Donnybrook, you've got so many really bad guys in here that some of them make Donald Ray Pollock's serial killers from The Devil All the Time look like Sunday school teachers.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yep, Donald was a big supporter. He actually read the manuscript before it had ever been sold.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he just said this, you know, he just really liked it, and he even passed it on to some friends and stuff, and I couldn't repay those guys enough. You know, they were just, because I'm a fan of theirs, and then they became a fan of mine. But we all kind of come from that same grain of working class roots too, so we kind of have an understanding about what one person look at and say, oh, this is horrible. Another person say, hey, I know those people, you know, like they can relate to it. So
Donnybrook is the novel by Frank Bill. He joins us on the program today. You have one scene in here where I had to go back and reread it two or three times. It's the one where the cop comes up to the house and realizes that they're making meth in there, and there's this family in there. And this particular scene, when we get down to it, I don't want to give it away what happens, but I think it's the most horrifying scene I've ever read in a book. What happens to this cop?
Well, it wasn't actually based on any truth as far as what happens to the cop, but it's one of those things where it's polarizing because you think of whenever you see families that get busted, they don't really have any concern for the kids because they're actually just cooking and getting by, and they're not worried about what it does to the children. And of course there's even more horrifying than that, just the kids being there. It's everything that happens, of course, like you say, to the cop. But that scene, I guess in a sense, I guess you could say it comes from somewhat of truth. I had a friend who was involved in a cooking meth and a house fire, and there were kids involved. Of course, everybody got out, and he got burned up a little bit. But, you know,
yeah,
we don't really see firsthand what a police officer goes through and what all they have to deal with. Granted, it's made up off of something else, but, yeah, he gets... He didn't get his due.
Uh-huh.
That's not what he had in mind, you know, when he entered the place. So,
and then we finally get to the Donnybrook, and when we get inside the actual gates, and of course, once you get in, you can't leave until it's over.
Right.
You're kind of trapped, but when you're inside there, it's kind of like you've entered, you know, hell. You it's like Hieronymus Bosch's vision of like the most horrifying. I mean, this is just unbelievable. Your depiction of this event, these people that are there.
Well, I thought of when I was a kid and I went to a Grateful Dead concert, or a couple of Grateful Dead concerts, actually. I was probably about 17, 18, somewhere around in there. And that was my vision, was how that was. It was kind of like a big party, you know. But then rather than having music, you have live fights and people are grilling and cooking and smoking, shooting and drinking. I mean, and it's in a sense, it's just because you've got all these working class people who've kind of lost everything, and this is how they spend their time with each other, in a sense. You know, it's kind of like, we have nothing else going on. We need to kind of like live it up.
Okay.
That was my vision, you know.
All right.
I'm not saying that's what people would do, but it was just kind of like, you know, when you're down on your luck, what do people do when they're down on their luck? Well, a lot of people like to sit at the bar and drink. Well, instead of having a bar, let me just have a big event.
Yeah. Okay, so it costs $1,000 to enter the Donnybrook. That's the entrance fee for a fighter. Not an observer.
No.
And the setup is then they give each fighter a number, and when they call your number, you go into this ring, and there's 20 fighters in the ring, and it's last man standing. And this is how you get down to the finals. Were they waiting to get down to like 20 guys out of 100 or 20 guys out of 1,000? Or, I mean, how does that work?
The way I envision it was you would get down to maybe one or two guys each day, and you'd have six guys left standing on Sunday.
Okay.
Of course, we don't get that far.
Okay.
The other thing was, you know, way back when I'm trying to remember whenever the UFC first started, you didn't really have any rules. The UFC used to be you had all these different disciplines. It didn't matter what you weighed. It didn't matter how big you were or anything. You had no weight classes. It was just you had two guys against each other. The guy who won would get to fight again that night. You know, the UFC went on all night until you had two guys left, and they might have to fight two or three times. And the UFC used to last several hours whenever you watched it. And then you would end up with two guys who were pretty much been beat on, you know, and got little rest, and then they had to face each other for this purse at the end of the night. And that was kind of how I saw the Donnybrook, because it was kind of this whole warrior class type thing, you know, last guy standing. Of course, UFC's not like that anymore. Now it's more of a sport, and they've placed rules in, and you have weight classes. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it was just kind of unique whenever it very first started out, because it was like a gladiator pit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. I mean, you had guys beat and bloody and bludgeoned, and it was just interesting. So
yeah.
That's kind of what spurred a lot of that.
We're talking to Frank Bill. His novel is Donnybrook, just published, and he joins us by telephone from, you're still in southern Indiana?
Yes.
Okay. And his first book was Crimes in Southern Indiana. It's a collection of short stories, and a good place to start and then move into Donnybrook if you want to kind of get the trajectory and the arc of Frank's writing. You still working your day job then? You work in a factory, right?
Yeah, I work Monday through Friday, basically a 40-hour week, loading shipping containers for overseas and inner-city LTLs and unloading raw goods and that type of stuff, incoming, outgoing, all that.
And you always keep your little notebook handy so you can write down what you're picturing?
Yeah. I've always got a little black moleskin I carry in my back pocket, and I also carry my journal. I got a leather-bound journal I carry and sometimes write in when I'm on my lunch break. Just depends.
Well, I know this book is getting some buzz. I mean, it's only been out for a few weeks, and I saw something that you wrote, I think this week for Daily Beast, where you got to kind of write an essay and do a little of editorializing, and I kind of got the impression from this piece that maybe you think that most American men are wimps.
Not necessarily. What I was trying to get the point across was where I come from and what influenced me. And yeah, I mean, as guys, of some kind of, you know, as if you're looking at how we are, what has influenced us, depending, it could be different across the board depending on where you were born and raised. Those were the things that I seen influenced my writing. The other thing is, sometimes when I step outside of myself, I always look at generations and I'm kind of like, man, you know, we would have never survived, or we wouldn't survive, some people wouldn't survive now as to what their families have put in to get them where they are.
Mm.
It's almost like we get, things are done too much for us rather than us learning how to do things for ourselves anymore. Not trying to call people out on that. I just would like people to understand where they come from. And that's one of the points I was trying to get across, is where I come from. And at the end, I try to sum that up by saying, you know, I'm giving back to those who gave to me. But it's kind of what society's accepted as the norm. You know, what would be the word I'm looking for? You know, it's like male identity, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then, no, I mean, some people's, you know, masculinity is defined on raising their children, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that, to be a good father and to raise your children and to be there for your son or your daughter. There's nothing wrong with that. I think people took a lot of things out of context, you know, it made them like step back and say, well, is he calling me out? Hey, take from it what you will, you know.
Or are you talking about commenters for that piece?
Yeah, there was a lot of, I mean, there was, for the most part, there was a lot of people who got what I was trying to say.
I see.
Others did not. And that's fine.
I thought it was very well written, and I, you know what? I didn't read the comments because I don't care what they think.
Exactly. Exactly. You're going to get from it what you want. You know, what somebody else would say defines them. That was the thing, was a lot of comments was they didn't get what I was saying, but then they turn around and said what defined them. So in a sense, it was kind of like, open your eyes. You know, you're basically doing the same thing I just did, only it's from your area and how you were raised.
Well, I guess I'll have to go back and read the comments, but I would expect on a particular blog like the Daily Beast that you definitely pushed some buttons.
Oh, there's no, hey, that's what it's there for. You know, I don't apologize for what I write.
Yeah.
You know, it's my opinion.
Yeah. Frank Bell joins us. His new novel is Donnybrook. You've got a character in here named Purcell who he's a very mysterious character. I really like him. And another character who I like, even though he's kind of a bad guy, is Fu.
Yes.
You expect Fu to surprise you.
Yeah. Purcell is, this is funny, but Purcell is kind of based on my grandmother's sister, who was a palm reader, a mystic, whatever you want to call her. She made money doing that. And fortune teller. You know, there's all these different words they use for it. But it was a weird upbringing to always have her come in. She'd come in the summer and she'd read everybody's palms and tell their future and all this stuff. But she lived away from here and made really good money doing this. Now, Fu was based on a Chinese martial arts teacher who taught. He lives way down in Kentucky. And he's not a vicious person like that, but he's a heck of a fighter. He came from China and went to college over here, and he was a bone setter and did acupuncture and everything. He was a really, really interesting guy, and I was fortunate enough to study with him and one of his students who was passing on his knowledge too. And his student's kind of based on Jarhead Earl. He's from Kentucky and everything. But I wanted to kind of catch, you know, there's different classes of people, and I wanted to kind of catch on that. Yeah, it seems like it's all kind of crazy and made up, but then it's something I've pulled from my own life, you know, so it's not so made up and it's not so far-fetched. So, and Fu is kind of surprising in a sense that he's a collector.
Right.
Of debts.
Right.
And the debts he's trying to collect are on basically for Chainsaw Angus and his sister and what they've left behind because of somebody who was into gambling. And the gambling debt happened to be Defoe's boss, the guy who brought him over here. So,
But he's kind of like Jarhead in that he commits crimes, but there's some sense of integrity to what he's doing.
Yeah, he has a heart, in a sense. I've written different short stories about him that have been published in different places just to kind of give his background and how he got here and things. But, he's the muscle.
Right.
He's the muscle for his boss, you know.
And the cop, the one that stumbles into the meth lab, he's a likable character, too. He's almost a martyr.
Yeah, in a sense.
Yeah.
He's got a little bit of dark history behind him. Don't ask me where that came from. It was just one of those things when you're sitting down writing and you start twisting things around. It's like, how can you make this even more crazy or / interesting?
Well, and, he's sort of an avenging angel.
Yeah. A lot of that comes too from my buddy. I've got a buddy who's a cop, and you know, a lot of questions I had about being a cop or things you go through when you're a cop or situations you find yourself in came from me talking to him. So.
Yeah. Well, I hate to bring up the name Jack Reacher. I know you're familiar with him, but when Jack Reacher is getting ready to get into a fight, He's really good at diagramming what he's going to do and how he's going to take out five guys at once by punching this guy first and then this guy and how he's going to diagram the whole fight. And you do a really great job in this book when there's something going on like that, some sort of conflict, of showing us exactly how Fu makes his moves. This is all very well diagrammed. I get the feeling that you talked to some people about this and made sure you had it all right.
No, actually, it just came. I mean, I started studying martial arts when I was 11 years old, and I studied up till I was about 29 or 30. But, you know, in between there, I studied Chinese martial arts, Korean martial arts. I boxed Western and Eastern. I studied Thai boxing for some time. And it was something we always did in class, was you broke down, if you got in this situation, how you react. And one of the things, as you grow older, you understand fighting, is you understand the mechanics of your body. And that was one of the things I wanted to show was, you know, guys who are like, I'm talking like real street fighters, guys who actually don't necessarily have studied a discipline, but they know how to fight, or they box. They always size things up. They size up the situation. They know their surroundings. They look at the guy. They look at how he walks. They look at, you know, does he use his left hand or his right hand when he does something? Is he a little off balance when he steps this way? Does he go heel to toe? It kind of gives them a sense of what they would do to that person. You know, in a real street fight, things only last about two or three movements anyway. You know, and I took all that into account. The other thing, too, whenever I would write the fight scene, is I would actually get up and think of how what I did or this character did, how that other person's going to react and how they're going to react. So I would have to go over it mentally in my head, write it down, and go back over and make sure it seemed real.
Gotcha. Wow. Well, it's a smasher. It's a slugfest. The book is Donnybrook by Frank Bill. It's his first novel, following his collection of short stories, Crimes in Southern Indiana. He's been my guest on the program today, and reading that piece, I think it was the one in the Daily Beast, we get the sense that your parents really had a powerful influence on you.
Yeah. My parents and my grandparents, you know, because they always struggled to make sure that I had what I needed to be who I am today. You know, without them, I wouldn't be here. And that came from hunting, fishing, even mowing the lawn. You know, they wanted to make sure everything you had was earned too. You know, they always wanted to make sure you knew right from wrong. Sometimes you didn't always follow those rules, and, you know, I got my rear end beat more than once for not doing things the way they should have been done, but that's cause and effect and how you learn growing up. But yeah, they had a really, really strong influence on me growing up. I had a good family. I still do.
Well, Frank, it's been a pleasure having you on the program again.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. The book is Donnybrook. Frank Bill wrote it for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McKeonis. Next week on the program, Philip Kerr returns with his latest novel featuring Bernie Gunther. It's called A Man Without Breath. Set in 1943 on the Eastern Front, and the Red Army is coming back through. Don't miss it. Philip Kerr next week in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.